Africa Live.
Welcome to Africa Live here on TheWhoRadio.com. I'm your host, Nyabinga Zimbabwe, and we've got a great show lined up for you today. Later on, we're going to be playing a presentation by Walter Rodney, an incredible African leader out of Guyana. And so we're going to hook you up with a presentation from him. But before we do that, we want to talk about an incredible production that I had the opportunity recently to see. Since January 18th, an incredible theater production has been running at the Raymond James Theater in St. Petersburg, Florida. Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, and it's a play that was written by playwright August Wilson. And I have here in the studio with me three actors who are playing roles of three of the main characters in the program, in the production. I have here Ben Kane, Kim Sullivan, and Ron Bob Simple, who are brothers, and welcome to Africa Live.
Oh, welcome, Bingo.
Thank you for having us, brother. Thank you for having us.
It's great to have the opportunity to have y'all here. On last night, I had the opportunity to see the production.
We saw you sitting in the front row, enjoying yourself.
Oh, yeah, I was. I think one of the other actors in the play said he saw the whole time I had a smile on my face, and that's true, because I was thoroughly enjoying it, and I hope that other folks do that. You have a real opportunity to, because the play has been extended.
Yes.
It was originally set to end on today.
Correct.
However, it's been extended for another week until February 20th, right?
That's correct.
So go get your tickets. You can go online right now. You can go to American State. It's American. What is it?
Yes, AmericanStage.org,
right?
Box office number. Box.
Yes, the box office.
It's area code 727-823-7529. That's 727-823-7529.
Okay, so go check that out. Go check this play out. If you don't see any other play this year, see Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. It's a very good production. So, just first of all, I want to ask: Can somebody tell our listeners what the setting of the play is?
Eeny, meeny, miny, mo.
Go ahead, Kim.
Ma Rainey is the day in the life of a recording session of the great Ma Rainey and her band. They come to Chicago for one day to record four or five tunes with their new trumpet player, played by Ben Kane, a.k.a. Levy. And he's a bit of a rabble-rouser. Mm. He has a whole different take on how the music is supposed to go. He represents the new sound, if you will, the clash of the new jazz and the sort of bebop sound. Actually, it's even pre-bebop, but he's a little more high-tech and a little faster, a little more... he wants a funkier rhythm played than the old sort of vaudeville tent show kind of music that we usually are normally used to playing. And he creates a lot of friction. He has baggage. He has issues and concernments. And and he brings them full circle to our play and upsets the whole apple cart. This normal day in the life takes a real odd turn thanks to Levy. And it's, I must say, as the role is played by Mr. Kane, he's wonderful to see as he watches, you know, as you watch his mind work, and you begin to understand just why he's wired so tightly, and it's quite devastating. The play has a lot of laughs, it has a lot of music, it has a lot of insight. Sharon Scott, who plays Ma Rainey, has one number that brings the house down.
Yes.
And Ron has a number that's pretty not bad.
All right,
you know, it's tolerable. He gets to it as best he can.
Brings the house up.
Stops the play cold, quite frankly. So it's a drama with music. But on that journey, there's quite a lot of stories being told. There's young, there's old, there's life, there's death, and I'm tired of hearing myself talk, so I'm gonna get the mic up to somebody else.
It's got complex characters. It's got really full kind of characters, and that's one of the things that I really enjoy about the play. That you really experience the characters in a very good way, and the way that you guys play those characters as well. I want to go into this character Levy. You know, because Ben, your character Levy is an interesting brother. He's
been through a bit of things. He's
got a conflict going on, a real struggle with a difficult, you know, type of past, which isn't really a very uncommon type of situation in that period. You know, but you know, can you tell us about, you know, your character and how you prepared yourself to play that character?
Okay, well, first I want to say, it's still not even uncommon to this day for somebody to have to go through things that they go on in life and affect them in a way that represents who we are right now, you know, because your past is what make you who you are today. So this character is very much relevant today as it is back then in 1927, I guess. The circumstances around it are a bit different, but all of us have some sort of situation. Well, this character, you know, to be an 8-year-old child and watch your mother. I'm not going to give away anything. I'm not going to give away anything. I want them to show up throughout this extension.
That's right.
So I'm just going to drop a little bit of it on there. You know, the brother goes through a very traumatic experience as an 8-year-old child that has to deal with his mother, and then soon after to lose his father to, you know, a very tragic circumstances. And then I think that for what I feel about the character at that point in time, he just dives himself into music. I mean, his horn is all he has in life, really. He didn't give up on God and family and everything, and all he has is music, which is kind of fueling him to do what he needs to do. And so I just take all those things in as an actor, everything that I know about his past, that from the book, from what the script tells me. I'm a kind of actor where I take the script and I read it at least 10 times based on the teachings of Richard Lawson. I don't know if you guys remember Richard Lawson.
Yeah.
Richard Lawson, my acting teacher back in L.A. And he said, you know, read a script 10 times before you even start learning the line, and then break down the script, what each character says about you, what you say about yourself. Put it on a board. Look at it so it's all ingrained in your brain so you know exactly what it is before you even start learning the line. And so then once I start learning lines, and then we get to the stage and start interacting with the other brothers and whoever else comes along, the buttons get to start pushed. I set up the buttons, and then they get pushed by these people, and then I have to respond, and then when the firecrackers go off, it's because they lit the fuse. I was minding my own business. I just was living my life the way I do, the way my brain works, and then these people, we come along, because that's what happens in life. I try to set up a very realistic life situation that I'm who I am.
Yeah.
And I want to be me, but when I bump into somebody and they got to be them, who knows what's going to happen? And this play is just a powder keg of all these different relationships and personalities coming into one little room with society packing us in even tighter.
Yeah, I want to take this time to invite our listeners to participate in this discussion that we're having. You can do so by calling in or emailing in. You can call the U.S. number, which is 727-565-1599. You can call the U.K. number, which is 020-8133-6629. Or you can call us through Skype for free anywhere in the African world. Our Skype ID is Uhuru Radio, and that's all one word, all lowercase. Or email us at dj@uhururadio.com. Now, Ron, when you picked up that upright bass.
Uh-oh.
I came front. I was a little jealous. I was a little jealous.
You're a good player today.
Because as a bass player myself, you know, I've never had the opportunity to play it upright, you know. And so I was like, man, I wish I was
I knew it would have done something to you. That's why I didn't even mention anything to you that I would.
But how did you prepare to be that character, Slow Drag? Slow Drag is a cool brother.
Yes, he is. And no, I wasn't typecast. in certain ways, I was. But I just want to go back to what you mentioned earlier, speaking about music. And, you know, music is a universal language. And it's because of music that these four musicians are together in this recording session with Ma Rainey. And when I realized that I would have the opportunity of being involved in yet another August Wilson, because I did Fences as well as Seven Guitars, I hadn't seen this play before. And when I read it, I heard about it. When I read it and I realized, I said, this thing is even deeper than Fences. You know, and when the producer and the director, you know, cast me a Slow Drag, I said, okay, fine. I'm from the Caribbean, as most of you listeners know, hosting Caribbean Forum, and we'll talk about the new broadcast this evening. I realized that I now have an opportunity to inject in this character a lot of my past growing up in the Caribbean. I've been living in the United States for almost 40 years now. So I pulled a whole lot of idiosyncrasies, a whole lot of traits from my dad, from my mother, my grandmother, and I infused it in this guy. And it turns out that here it is, Slow Drag, because with this emotional roller coaster in this play with all the characters, you mean, I had the opportunity now, especially at the end of the show, when a tragedy occurs, to get emotional to the point that, you know, I mean, it affects me. And I must admit, you know, I mean, that this emotional roller coaster that we've been going through, that I have been going through, you know, I mean, it's taking a toll. Because you can feel your body, you can feel your mentally, physically, I mean, even psychologically, you realize that there have been changes in this guy. Not that I'm really waiting for the 20th to come around, because, you know, things change after the 20th, if you know what I mean, fellow actors. but the experience that we've been having, and I dug deep into who I am and all these experiences that I've had over these few years that I've been on this plane, and I'm proud of what I do.
Yes. Well, having watched that, I'm proud of what you did, too.
We're proud of him, too. We like what he does. He's not bad. I thought he'd never master it, but he got it.
We have a caller. Caller, you on there?
Yeah, how you doing? I was just calling in to congratulate the cast on the production. I've seen the play several times.
You should have.
I saw it about
He's a mole. That's a mole.
Already.
I know that voice. I know it. Who is that? That's a mole.
Mark
Southers.
What up, boy?
I think I saw it about 30 times already down here.
Director.
My name is Mark Southers. I'm the director, and I just wanted to call and congratulate the cast and the crew and everybody on a successful run. I'm going to come back and see it again next week.
That's not my blocking.
Hey, Kim. How you doing, man? Cool. So I just called in to say hi to everybody, you know, and if you didn't get a chance to see the show, I would suggest you guys go see it. It's been extended to the 20th, right?
Yes, it has. Yes.
Great. Yes. So hello, everybody. Just wanted to say hi. Continue doing the great work you do at the American Stage Theater, and don't miss the show.
We appreciate you calling in, Mark, and
okay.
I would like to say this publicly because, you know, we're being heard all over the world, that you came and you laid down and you left a masterpiece at American States Theater. You know, the responses have been great and have been encouraging, and we salute you, my brother.
Yes, indeed.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. It's a great cast, and it is a wonderful, expertly written script by my good friend and mentor, August Wilson. And hopefully these radio shows will be happening 100 years from now, talking about his work. and I'm sure it will. And hey, we're coming down to meet with American States because we're going to be doing the very first International August Wilson Theater Festival in Pittsburgh in 2012 at the wonderful August Wilson African American Center, Cultural Center in Pittsburgh. And we're coming down to officially invite American Stage Theater to be part of the festival, which is going to take place in August of 2012. Right. And we're going to be doing all 10 plays in the cycle. We're going to have some pretty big name folks involved. So hopefully we'll all be back in Pittsburgh together.
Yes, indeed. So
thank you all for allowing me to jump on the air there. And keep up the great work, Ron, Kim, Ben Kane. Who else is there? Anybody else?
No, just the three of us.
Cool. And, hey, you guys are doing great work, man. It was a pleasure to work with you all.
Before you go.
Go ahead, Kim.
I just want to thank you for allowing me to participate in my first wedding on stage, which was more show than
you played that piano, man. Thank you for playing the wedding march for us.
No problem. No problem. It was my pleasure. If I live to be 100, I will never forget that. I will never forget. So how is Lacey? How is the bride? How's it going?
Everybody's doing great, man. Everybody's doing wonderful.
That's good. All right.
Yeah, it was great. It was a great experience. And I was glad that the theater company was open for that to happen. It was a memorable day in our lives. If no one knows what we're talking about, my wife and I were married on stage, on the Ma Rainey stage, with the Ma Rainey cast in a play. And August's words were part of it, brought forth by the great Kim Sullivan in his monologue, I Married a Woman. So it was a wonderful experience, man. It was one of the best experiences in my life, and I'm glad we got to do it in warm weather, you know, with great people around the crowd, great folks.
It was different.
So I don't want to eat a bunch of the time, but
it was different. That's for sure. God bless. It was all right. It was fun.
So for you doing this production is a life changing experience in more ways than one.
Yes, it was. Hey, Ron, do we have time? I want to introduce the world to the new CEO of the August Wilson Center. We're on our way, actually, to Louisville to talk with some actors there and a theater company down there. But I want to introduce you really quick to the new CEO of the August Wilson Center, Mr. Andre Guest.
Great, great.
Hello, how is everyone?
Doing well.
Very well. Very
congratulations.
Well. Thank you. Thank you so much. We're just so proud to have Mark, and we hired him right before he came down to be with you guys, and I'm glad that we were able to snag him. I mean, he's just a treasure. I mean, he's where he belongs. He's a son of August, and he needs to be at the center, leading the charge for theater. And he's kicking the bull by the horn.
While we have you guys on the line, can I have you just speak to our audience? Anyone who may be unfamiliar with who August Wilson is, can you say something about the significance of August Wilson, who he was?
Well, I pale in comparison in terms of my knowledge of August Wilson with Mark, but what he means to me and what I think he means to the center in terms of bearing his name is this was the guy who came to international prominence by talking about a very, very small plot of land in a relatively small city. And he was able to take 9 of his 10 plays and talk about that neighborhood and the people that came from that neighborhood and have a universal appeal that would appeal to all human beings, which really shows the universality of the human condition. And that's not something that we often see with African Americans, is that we often see ourselves in the art of other people, but it's very rare that other people see themselves in our art, because we just don't, you know, may often feel that we can't do that. But you know, August, you know, sort of belied that. He walked in the opposite direction of that and said that there's something to be known about the plight of African Americans, that everybody across this planet can see themselves in that work. And I think that's what great art is what you can connect and project yourself onto something that is not about you, but see yourself in it, then it's great art. So he was able to do that.
Great, great. I really want to appreciate you guys for calling in and being a part of this program today. I think you've added much more to it. So thank you so much for calling in.
Okay, I'm going to give it back to Mark so we can say your final goodbye.
Okay, hey, thanks for allowing us to get on the air, man. And keep up the great work. We'll see you guys in a few days.
All right. See you in a few days, Mark.
Take it, Mark.
Okay, all right. Stubble rough your toe.
All right, so I want to, while we've got some time left, first of all, let me just remind our listeners or any that have just joined us, let you know that we are talking with members of the cast of Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, a production that is in the Raymond James Theater in St. Petersburg, Florida. You can check it out. The play has been extended because it's such a great play. So, you know, take advantage of the extension. It's extended until February 20th. Ron, can you hit us with the information for how people can get tickets?
Yes, the American Stage is located at 163 3rd Street North in the heart of St. Petersburg. And the number you can call for further information and or tickets is 727-823-7529. That's 727-823-7529. Or you can log on to their website, which is americanstage.org.
Great. So take this opportunity now. While you're online listening to us, you know, just open up another window and reserve
those tickets.
Yeah, reserve that ticket, you know, because I caught it. And I'm glad I caught it. And you need to catch it, too.
Bingo, was this your first August Wilson play?
This was my first August Wilson play.
Wow.
Yeah.
What a way to start.
Yeah. Trial by fire, yeah. This was my first August Wilson play, performing in it back in 1995. I was fortunate enough to be chosen by one of August's contemporaries, Claude Purdy, to play Ben's role, Levy. I was young and lean, and at that time, you know, and now I'm old and weazened. But
weazened?
Remember that?
Reading too many books.
And I must say, when I first saw the play, 87, I think it was when it debuted on Broadway, I dare say I didn't get it. And it left me, you know, everyone was talking about it. This was the hot ticket. And I couldn't quite get my hand around it. And I met August soon afterwards, and I didn't dare tell him I didn't get the play. I thought the performances were courageous. But it didn't quite gel for me in my head as to why Levy did what he did. And only when I got a chance to do it and pick the play apart and read it over it several times did I realize, oh, okay, this is what this guy was about. You know, the ticket I had, I was way up in the balcony. I might have missed certain nuances. I might have missed certain things. Even Rock Dutton, who performed the role of Levy, some 10 years later said, you know, I didn't do my best work then. You know, I was kind of on the prod, giving the other actors a little grief. I thought maybe his performance led me in the wrong direction. But only after I began to pick Levy apart and understand just why he does what he does, did I understand just what he's bringing to the table and what August was bringing to the table. August is one of our most prolific writers, and he tells a great story. And he tells it from everybody's point of view. Everyone has a chance to state where they're coming from. The old, the young, the males, the females, and he's almost Shakespearean in his scope and his focus, and it's big and it's broad. And his one saving quality, though, is that he brings black love into a real serious focus. It's Levy's love for his mother and father that drives him. It's Ma's love for her nephew that drives her. Mm. It's our love for black music that makes us continue to drive in the snow and go to places like Chicago where it's cold to record on an off day in the middle of a tour. Mm-hmm. It's wonderful to see when it happens, and it's August's greatest quality. In all the 10 plays that he's written, he shows a lot of black love. It's our only commodity that we have that we can really offer, and it's something to see when you can actually see it up close.
Yeah.
It's truly a history lesson. That's what I really love about August. They don't teach these stories inside mm-hmm. of any classroom mm-hmm. in St. Petersburg or Michigan or anywhere else. I mean, but to watch August take these stories and make them a slice of life that we didn't know about or that mm-hmm. we should have known about, but nobody ever taught us. He really brought that to me the first time I ever saw it. He taught me so much about who I was as a black person that I had no idea knowing.
Yeah.
Just because nobody ever told me, and I learned little bits and pieces. I didn't really understand. I think my first August Wilson piece was Joe Turner, and to understand about the passage, you know, I was like, oh, I didn't even really realize, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. what had happened and how many people had died in
the Middle Passage.
In the Middle Passage, and mm-hmm. you know, it was a scene in there where you have to actually experience what it was like to go through that. Mm-hmm. And it took me the longest to wrap my head around it, but once I got that, I was like, man, what he's showing people. And I remember people in the audience watching it being a little uncomfortable. And it happens here in this place.
Yes, it does.
People will laugh at certain places, and you're like, why are they laughing? Mm-hmm. Because it's so uncomfortable and unfamiliar to them. Mm-hmm. And it's not until the damage is done that they go, oh.
And as you rightfully said, you know, it is a teaching tool.
Yes.
You know, and even though the audience, the makeup of the audience so far has been predominantly Caucasian, they get it, because one of the actors, I think, met an elderly white woman a couple of nights ago, you know, I mean, who lived in the 20s, and right. she admitted, you know, that she was taken back to that period of time, experiencing that sort of life and how blacks were treated, you know, I mean, back in the 20s. And, you know, to hear the responses of members of the audience, and of course, you know, when brothers and sisters are out there, it's a whole different show, because they'll be talking back to you, don't take it. Don't take it. When you come to see the show, you'll realize why I whispered those words.
Binga, can I add one more last thing?
Go ahead.
I just want to commend the American stage, and Todd Olson particularly, for taking on the task of doing all 10 of this man's plays. August did a very clever thing in saying, I'm going to write 10 plays covering our diaspora from the 1900s to the 20th century. Mm-hmm. And Todd Olson has taken it upon himself to will his theater to do all 10 of this man's plays. It's a courageous and life-affirming move on his part, and we just cannot thank him enough for doing all 10 of these plays, and for us to get a chance, hopefully, to do all 10 of these plays and tell this story 10 times over. It takes all 10 for you to get the total picture. So I urge people to come out, and you've now missed 4 if you missed this one, but jump on the bandwagon. Wherever you fall in, you will be just fine. Mm-hmm. Come to the show.
Tell our brothers and sisters to come out, because without them coming out seeing this,
yes, because, you know, you need to get the opportunity,
yes.
you know, to experience this play in particular, mm-hmm. and the other August Wilsons, because, you know, as Kim just mentioned, they're doing one each year, so sometimes you may have to wait 9-10 months before you see the next one. But yes, the American stage ought to be commended for committing to doing this entire cycle.
It's our people's language.
Absolutely.
Words,
you know. It's our language. Yeah, and the language is universal. You know, it may be a little painful, but life is painful.
For sure.
Yeah. But it's real. That's the thing.
Yes,
it's
it
real.
Is.
You
yes,
know,
it is.
Despite the pain that you may see and discomfort, mm-hmm. You also get the other end of the spectrum. You see, you know, the joking around and and the having fun, mm-hmm. and you know, you really get a real experience, you know, of life in that period.
So. From soup to nuts.
No pun intended, right?
And we'll leave that at that.
Yeah, right.
So, again, you know, check out the play. Get your tickets. You can go to AmericanStage.org to get tickets. You can also call the box office.
Yeah, 727-823-7529.
So get tickets. You've got until February 20th to see it. Of course, you may not have until February 20th to get tickets, because up to now it's been selling out. You know, every night.
And this extended week, we're just Wednesday through Sunday, and not Tuesday. There's no show on Tuesday.
Okay.
So it's Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, 2 on Saturday, and 1 on Sunday.
Yeah. Well,
I mean, I hope people make it out to the show, but if they don't, please, please research who August Wilson is, because it's a shame that I meet brothers and sisters and I say August Wilson, they're like, who?
Mm-hmm. And like, mm-hmm. this, but they know Tyler Perry, right?
Yeah, yeah. I, you know, and it's nothing against anybody else. I'm just saying that this guy is so brilliant, mm-hmm. that for our people not to know who he is a sin. It's a horrible travesty that, you know, if I say I'm doing this play, like, I think I heard of him. I'm like, dude, mm-hmm. without this dude, mm-hmm. I don't know what theater would be about for real for us. So the brothers is working right now, thanks to this man.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Look him up.
And speaking of working, where can people, beyond February 20th, Where can people see you guys?
Here it is. Well, serve you up a big softball. You have to hit it.
Well, after we close on February 20th, I'm doing my one-man presentation, The Spirit of Marcus Garvey, at Studio at 6:20. And I'm looking forward to that. We are backed by popular demand. And during this African History Month, unfortunately, it's the shortest month of the year, even though our history is every day. But again, just like August Wilson, our community, our people, our brothers and sisters, our children need to know who Marcus Garvey is.
Yes.
Not was. Who he is. He's responsible for a lot. A lot of his ideologies and philosophies are right through August Wilson's plays. You know, Malcolm X's father was a Garveyite. And I have just committed myself to keep his name, his spirit, and his ideologies and philosophies alive with my one-man presentation, The Spirit of Marcus Garvey. I've had the opportunity to, excuse me, to take it to Senegal, there in Gore Island, Elmina Castle in Ghana, in Bermuda, in Barbados, Jamaica, throughout the United States, and I will continue to do it as long as I have a breath in my body. The opportunities that I get, members of the audience, the last time I appeared there at the studio at 6:20, it was a brother, he was 92 years old, who actually listened to Marcus Garvey at 138th Street in Manhattan. Back in. So, you know, when I meet those individuals and I get those vibes, you know, that's what really propels me to keep on doing what I'm doing. And I'm happy to get the opportunity. You know, it has not been an easy road because, you know, not everybody is going to accept what you're doing. Mm-hmm. But that's beside the point. And there's a story that I've told many, many times in Senegal. After I did my presentation, I went into a room and sat and cried like a baby. I don't ever recall before crying and feeling so good to know what just happened. Marcus Garvey never physically made it to the continent, but his impact there was tremendous. And to know that I have taken his name, his spirit, I won't say his looks, but the whole resemblance, the Garvey, the whole energy to the continent, to Senegal, right above the door of no return. On Gore Island. It was a tremendous experience, and I was just lifted up by those brothers and sisters in Senegal, and incidents like that, it just keeps firing me up. And looking forward, it's at the studio at 6:20, February the 26th at 8 p.m. You can either log on to the website at studio, the at sign at 6:20, or you can log on to my website, which is ronbobsemple.com. ronbobb-semple.com. Before I get off the soapbox, you listeners, I just want to encourage you to tune in this evening here on the Uhuru Radio Network, starting this evening from 7 to 10 p.m. It's Golden Sunday Songs with Ron Bob Semple.
Oh,
as you can tune in and you can listen to those easy listening and romantic songs of yesteryear. I know many folks look forward to Valentine's Day, even though Valentine's Day, Mother's Day, Father's Day is every day. So we're going to play some love songs tonight.
What? And no soca, no ska, no calypso? What are you talking about, boy?
Easy listening, yeah. You can hear some of that in the Caribbean Forum every Saturday morning from 9 until 11.
Now you're talking. Now you're talking.
Yes, so 9 to 11 Saturday mornings here on the Uhuru Radio Network, and on Sunday evenings from 7 until 10 p.m.
So definitely check out that Garvey play. I'm going to be there on the 26th, it's important to note Garvey influenced even the period, that period where the Ma Rainey's Black Bottom,
yes. Right, because the period that I deal with my Garvey presentation is from 1916 to 1925.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, just around that era, I mean, because the Ma Rainey was set in 1927,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, Garvey contributed so much.
Yes.
And I just like to enjoy, and bring your children.
Mm.
Bring your children, because they need to learn. A lot of adults need to learn about Garvey, and a lot of those heroes and sheroes who have made a contribution to our existence today and be responsible for a lot of things that we do or are afforded to do. So bring your children. It's February 26th at 8 p.m. at Studio at 620 in St. Petersburg, Florida. And I said you can log on to my website and get further information. And I'm looking forward to seeing you.
All right.
So, Ben, what are you up to next?
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm
going back home and rest. this tour has worn me out. If you like to catch the stories, every once in a great while I make an appearance on One Life to Live, the soap opera. I play Judge Runyon. Other than that, I have nothing, and it's the rare actor who knows what he's going to do after this gig, so I congratulate my buddies that they got gigs. But it's been great having him at St. Pete, but I need a little respite when I get back.
Yeah.
But rest is a new dance, because I'm sure once I get to New York, it'll be hopping.
How about you, Ben?
I don't know what I'm working on next. I got a couple of things that are coming out. Actually, a movie that just started on Hallmark Channel called Accidentally in Love. I'm in that right now. Got an independent film coming out sometime this year called Guido. And I did a film with John Singleton and Taylor Lautner that's coming out soon, this summer sometime. So just those things in the works. And you can go to BenCain.net, and it's always whatever things I'm working on, BenCain.net. And all of my work and whatever's coming out is always there.
All right. Be looking out for these brothers, because each one of them is very skilled. And really, the whole cast of this play.
Yeah, we've got a tremendous ensemble, you know, and there are three Caucasian actors in the production. It's a cast of 10. It's the largest cast of the August Wilson series. And we gel nicely. We have some a good camaraderie and we are there for each other. Mm-hmm. You know, we just met, you know, in 5-6 weeks ago, and we have really come together and gelled, and it shows on stage because we hear the responses, we hear from those members of the audience. You know, I mean, how you guys are just, you know, I mean, not acting, which is what I believe in. You know, I mean, you create a character and you're placed in a situation, just be the role, forget about acting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just immerse yourself in that character and just be. And it shows, you know, even on and off stage, because, you know, we have to have that camaraderie, you know. Well, up until 5 minutes before we go on, we could be different.
Yeah. Well, I just wanted to thank you, brothers, for coming on again and allowing our audience to experience who you are, even outside of the play. And yes. And to, you know, to inform our listeners about the extended period of this play, which is up to February 20th. That's again, right. Go check it out. But want to just thank you guys for coming in and talking with us today about the play.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us, Baker. Thanks for having us.
Africa Live.
All right, so we're going to continue here on Africa Live. Before we go any further, we're going to play a song for you, Ma Rainey's Black Bottom.
Uh-oh. Are you heard the rap? Ah, boy, I'm gonna show you the best. Ma Rainey's gonna show you her black bottom. Way down in South in Alabama, I got a friend called Samson Sammy, who's crazy about all the ladies dancing. Black bottom South and you baby princess. The other night at a thrill affair, soon as the boys found out that I was there, he said, come on, Lord, let's go to the cabaret. When I got there, you ought to hear me say, for to see the dance, you call the black bottom. I wanna learn that dance. Oh, to see the dance, you call your big black bottom. They put the end of dance. All the boys in the neighborhood, they say your black bottom is really good. Come on and show me your black bottom. I wanna learn that dance. I wanna see the dance of all the black bottoms. should call you Big Black Bottom. Him put this in my trash. Early last morning, about the break of day, Grandpa told my grandmother, heard him say, she opened it and showed the old man your black bottom. I wanna learn that dance. Now I'm gonna show you my black bottom. Wait till you see that dance. Wait until you see me do my big black bottom. It's put you in a trance. Oh, do it, Ma. Do it, honey. Look out now, Ma. You're getting kind of rough there. You better be yourself now. Careful now. Not too strong. Not too strong, Ma. I'm done. Don't be yours. My black bottom.
On Sundays from 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, we'll bring you Golden Sunday Sounds with me, Ron Bob Semple. A relaxing 3 hours of music from around the world. Music is the food of love. So tune in every Sunday evening from 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Golden Sunday Sounds.
Listen to this. Shh. They call it Stormy Monday. Well, then Tuesday's just as bad. They call it Stormy Monday. Oh Lord, but Tuesday's just as bad. Wednesday's worse. Lord, and Thursday's all so sad.
Eagle flies on Friday, and Saturday I go out and play. Saturday I go out and play. Sunday I go to church, and I kneel down and pray.
What you say?
On me. Lord, have mercy on me.
Lord, have mercy on me. You know I'm trying to find my baby. I want somebody to place on a home to me. Learn to love me or leave me.
Either one you wanna do.
Learn to love me or leave me. Either one you wanna do. Yeah.
because you see some strange things is happening now, baby.
Look out there.
And something could happen to you.
That's right. But you know what? The reason why I'm for this. And the night find me crying. And daylight find me crying too.
You cry all the time. Midnight find me crying. Babe, and daylight find me crying too.
You can say it again.
You better watch yourself now, pretty baby. Oh, because something could happen to you. If you know, you know.
See ya.
Back to Africa Live here on AhuRadio.com. I'm your host, Nyabinga Zimbabwe, and we were talking earlier with some of the cast members of Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, a production that's running right now here in St. Petersburg, Florida, at the Raymond James Theater. And of course, the run for that that production has been extended to February 20th. So for those who have not had the opportunity, who are in this area and had not had the opportunity to see that play, you should go and do so. Go get your tickets at AmericanStage.org. Now, I want to go into a portion of the program where we're going to play a presentation for you from a really important revolutionary by the name of Walter Rodney. Walter Rodney is a brother who was a leader in the struggle for freedom for African people in Guyana, but whose reach and influence reaches far beyond Guyana. In fact, he himself for a time was in Tanzania, Jamaica, and other areas, and had a real impact on the struggle. He was one who was very critical of the African middle class, the black middle class that came into power under neocolonialism. He really was a great intellectual, African intellectual, and revolutionary. He was assassinated on June 13th, 1980, in Guyana, by the government of Forbes Burnham. But his memory, his influence still lives on. And if you listen to this presentation that we're going to play for you today, you can see why Walter Rodney's influence continues to live. And so we're going to play for you this piece from Walter Rodney on a class analysis in Guyana.
When slavery ended in the Caribbean, as many people even casually familiar with the Caribbean would know, the population was at that time essentially African-based, the vast majority of the population. And it was subsequent to slavery that a large number of other ethnic groups were introduced to fulfill the function of labor in the society. Indian immigration was the largest single sector of immigration, but we also had immigrants from China, from the Madeira and the Azores Islands, from Europe itself to some extent, from the Caribbean islands, and so on. But the Indian immigration was the largest, and the most consistent source was the subcontinent of India. Consequently, at a certain point in the late 19th century in Guyana, and indeed in Trinidad, the Indian population became, first of all, a substantial minority, and in the case of Guyana, in the present century, they became the largest single ethnic group. And that is the basis of the so-called racial division in our society. When African and Indian met in a Caribbean context, for all practical purposes, that was their first physical and or social confrontation. It was not a continuation of relations which had independently been established between Africans and Indians. And therefore it meant that their appreciation and evaluation of each other had to develop in situ. Whatever relations exist between Africans and Indians in the Caribbean were developed right there in the Caribbean. They are not relations which represent a carryover from any other type of contact which Africans had with Indians. And yet, at a very early stage of the relationship between Africans and Indians in Guyana, it was perceptible that both sides were hurling racial or racist barbs at each other. Now, where did these barbs originate? How did they develop in such a short time in the relations between Africans and Indians? In pursuing this question, it was interesting to identify the stereotypes which Africans and Indians utilize with respect to each other. The stereotype of the African was brought straight from slavery, the stereotype which in our society was known as Kwashi, Kwashi being a gross deformation of the Akan name Kwesi. Kwesi became Kwashi in the Creole rendition of the word. And the African slave was given a series of attributes which those who know the literature on racism would readily recognize. The attributes of being lazy, of being stupid, at one point, although capable of carrying on the most back-breaking work, is still, in a controversial fashion, in a contradictory fashion, regarded as lazy, regarded as given to music, given to idleness, and so on and so forth. The whole package that still, in one way or another, informs some of the racist literature and the racist stereotypes of the black man. Now that was Kwashi, the African. The Indians inherited that assessment, that stereotype of Kwashi. They had no notion of who Kwashi was because they had not met Kwashi. They had just arrived in the society. But they inherited lock, stock, and barrel, that stereotype that had derived from the plantation society.
At the same time, the modified plantation society of the post-slavery era quickly built up its own stereotype of the Indian. The Indian was called Sami. That sounds rather anglicized, but what it really referred to was the title Swarmy, S-W-A-R-M-Y, which in effect, in the English version at any rate, that would be the spelling, but it relates to an Indian of a certain, a Hindu, and a person who had religious training and a religious inclination, a priest almost. Now, the word was taken then out of the names of many Indians, like Ram Sami or Vera Sami, and they simply said, this is Sami. Now, Sami was also reduced to a stereotype of a rather cunning, given to idleness also, but willing to work under certain conditions in order to advance his own aims, but not to be trusted, and so on and so forth. There is another stereotype that is built up of Sami. And again, interestingly enough, the Africans soon acquired the stereotype of Sami. So the plantation society was producing its stereotypes of these two racial groups, and because of its own economic as well as cultural dominance, the society imposed these stereotypes on both groups of working people, African and Indian. I won't go into any further detail on that, but maybe there is a broader lesson to be drawn. In many of the studies on racism, there has arisen in the last several years a tendency to want to try and find the roots of racism in some very distant epoch, using sources like the Bible, using the very earliest contacts between Africans and Europeans. And it seems to me that one of the weaknesses of that scholarship and the methodology which it utilizes is that it takes issues such as acts of individual prejudice as between white and black, or the way that a particular black is treated in European society, but it does not follow through to see where that prejudice is transferred from being a mere individual prejudice to being part of an institutionalized relationship. And it is only in the plantation society, only in the slave society of the New World, that the framework was established precisely for those institutional relations, so that the racism ceased to be merely a quirk, a personal aberration, and became instead a rationalization for a whole system of production. And this is why there's a qualitative difference between racism as understood in the New World, as it developed particularly in the 17th and 18th century, and any other of individual prejudice which can historically be illustrated as having occurred prior to that date. In other words, it seems to me that even after one has illustrated that racism existed before capitalism, it still remains true that a capitalist system, in a particular phase of its accumulation, in which it required to subordinate non-white people in a particular way, was responsible for both aspects of modern racism, namely the involvement of race as a category in determining how people had access to the means of production, the involvement of race in the actual production relations, and secondly, inevitably, the dissemination of racist ideas as a necessary part of the ideological superstructure to maintain that type of exploitation. So it is within the Caribbean, it seems to me, that one must go back. Just as it is necessary, and many scholars are finding it necessary in recent times, to return to the 17th century, to return to that very decisive moment in the expansion of the European economy, when it became an international economy, to understand the genesis of capitalism on a world scale. In the same way, it seems to me that we have to look at the development of the said Caribbean society to understand the development of racism as it exists today. And secondly, one of the interesting ways of seeing how that racism was very much rooted in the immediate environment and must necessarily be a social phenomenon is merely to look at the way in which Guyanese delineate because the racial delineations are different from other, from those which are plain in other parts of the world. All of the migrant peoples who came to Guyana were considered as a specific race. Therefore, when Portuguese came from the islands of Madeira and the Azores, the Portuguese, up until today, are regarded as a racial group in Guyana. That is a definition of race. Inable to the population to refer to one race and to the Portuguese as another race, because their perception of race was inextricably bound up with their perception of how people made their living, how they had access to the means of production. And initially, the Portuguese, like the Indians, like the Chinese, came into our society as bondmen. The indentured Indians who live on the estate themselves have their own conflict with labor, with capital. Again, it didn't take them very long. They were brought in to break the back of African working class militancy. And they succeeded, the planters succeeded in so doing. But after a few years, the very Indian population brought in as the scab labor of the time became the new proletariat confronting capital on the plantation. And hence a series of labor manifestations from the 1860s onwards involving the indentured population. So really, within a decade of their introduction, because the main introduction of Indians came in 1846-47, within 10 or 12 years of that introduction, the Indian indentured population had become a very combative section of the working class in Guyana. And therefore, I would argue that what we had in the 19th century, and right up until the early 1920s in Guyana, was a class struggle which was fractured along racial lines. The African workers had their contradictions with European capital. Indian workers had their contradictions with capital, with the same capital. What is true is that the racial division made it difficult, if not impossible, for them to forge common links across class lines. But this does not mean that the class struggle was not continuing, because it is precisely the class struggle that altered the conditions of death. One enters into a situation with an awareness that what matters is production relations. This seems to me the baseline. We start with production relations. We examine those production relations. Where, of course, classes emerge and where their relationships become decisive relations in the society, then we follow those relations. At the same time, we have to be conscious that it has been possible within the capitalist system to create racial or at least race-class situations. Situations in which race itself becomes one of the factors located within the system of production itself, where the labor is recruited specifically on a racial basis, where access to land is denied you if you are of a particular racial origin, and therefore in that sense it creates race as an economic category itself. But when you say when you said African or black or Creole in the 19th century in Guyana, this automatically meant a certain set of economic limitations, of social limitations that were built into the system itself, quite apart from whether Africans or Indians liked each other. And of course, there is a second dimension. Outside of the actual production relations, one must take into account how the ideas developed by the society, inherited by the society, are themselves being propounded and are themselves serving to strengthen and or dissolve the system. And it is this aspect of racism which I would consider as racism in terms of manipulation that I am going to want to speak about and to bring it up to the present. That is to say, if the idea arising out of certain social relations is an idea that places races in a system of ordination and subordination, places them in a ranking of inferior and superior and so on, then that idea itself becomes a social force. And we need to identify, it seems to me, its class roots and the mechanisms by which this idea or these ideas have their impact on the society. My contention is that whenever there was, and there were many, social conflicts involving Africans and Indians, as there were, and some of the scholarship has pointed out, clashes between Africans and Indians before the modern period in Guyana, we should really look both at the ideas that were expressed by the two groups, as well as their actual economic posture at the time. And we should try to determine whether a clash between African and Indian is always a racial clash. I think this is a problem of analysis that has been glossed over. People assume that if an African group and an Indian clash, then you call that a racial clash. I've been looking at several examples of African-Indian conflicts in our history. For instance, a group of sugar workers who are Africans demanding a particular price might come into conflict with a group of Indian sugar workers who are prepared to accept a lesser price. Or a group of Indian peasants or semi-peasants in a struggle for land may come up in conflict against Africans who either hold that land or hope to obtain that land at the same time. And these are simply described as racial. To my mind, that is to describe their superficial aspects. In the same way as in Africa, people are quick to describe a conflict as tribal because it takes place between two quote-unquote tribes, or conflict as ethnic because it takes place between two ethnic groups. And yet it seems to me that we have to have some procedure for determining what is superficial and what is essential about these phenomena of clashes between racial groups. And one can use some very simple yardsticks. Basically, I ask myself whether the conflict which one is looking at would have occurred in a racially homogeneous society. That's one of the simple questions which I use to try and determine whether it's really a racial conflict. If two groups of different racial and or ethnic origins are in conflict, and one is tempted to attribute that conflict to their ethnic origin, then we can have a hypothesis, would that conflict have occurred in a racially homogeneous society? Because if the answer is yes, then quite clearly the factor of race is either irrelevant or very marginal in the whole discussion, because it could have occurred between two sets of whites or two sets of Indians, as the case might be. And in many instances, this is precisely what one finds, that the kinds of struggles between Africans and Indians were really struggles that were rooted in the lopsided nature of colonial social relations, social and economic relations, rooted in the deliberate policy of creating a surplus labor market in the colonial context, rooted in the policy of deliberately withholding land so that you could hold back the development of a peasantry in the society. And within that context, workers and or peasants had intra-class conflicts such as they would have had in any other kind of society. If you went to England, looking at English history, social history in the 19th century, there was a lot of rural discontent and localized rural violence between one group of farm workers in a particular area who go out to sell their labor. And the penetration of capitalist relations in the countryside allowed the capitalists to send to another area to bring in farm workers at a cheaper rate. Now these fellows fought each other with sticks and stones and sometimes with more than that. Two sets of whites, sometimes from adjacent villages. Now nobody called that racism or tribalism. It was an intra-class conflict rooted in the inequalities of the socioeconomic structure. And it seems to me that many of the conflicts which are erroneously described as tribal, ethnic, racial and the like in the Third World are precisely conflicts of that type that would have taken place within an ethnically or racially homogeneous society. What is true and where we can designate clashes as genuinely racial or racist clashes is where we have a racist ideology, the fact of ideology, underpinning the conflict or arising out of the conflict as conscious rationalizations on the part of those involved of the meaning and significance of their activities. And the best examples would be recent examples. In 1962, we had communal violence. I think in any usage of the term racial or racist, those episodes of violence in Guyana in the early 1960s were in fact racial. That Africans and Indians got involved in a confrontation where they believed, rightly or wrongly, that they were defending African and or Indian interests. In that sense, they presented the struggle to themselves as a racial conflict. And it is important that we try to understand how it is and why it is that race assumes that primacy as an explanatory factor in social and political life. Because ever since 1962, it has remained a potent force, although not necessarily the dominant force in Guyanese politics. And it is a potent force in Trinidadian and Surinamese politics, both of them having the same ethnic structure as we do in Guyana. And that really brings me to the third of my original propositions, where I want to look at the ways in which racist ideas have been deliberately manipulated. When the planters brought Indians into Guyana in 1847 in large numbers, it would be difficult to say that they consciously and knowingly said, let us get Indians in order that Indians should conflict with Africans. I think this would be asking too much. This would be suggesting a certain planned class history, as it were. And classes do not necessarily plan their own history. In fact, more often than not, the capitalist class has bungled into its own history. Nevertheless, having brought Indians into Guyana in large numbers, the planters soon began discussing what, after all, was evident, that there was a very useful byproduct of the labor being Indian, and that is that you can divide African from Indian. And they made this clear in their own discussions. They said, not only are we getting more labor to create a surplus, not only are we able to control labor better because of indentureship, not only are we getting cheaper labor, but we have the additional, almost priceless advantage that we have created a potential wedge within the working class. And we must work on this. We're not going to take this for granted. We will consciously work to maintain that division at the level of culture, and most importantly, at the level of social action, whenever that social action threatened the plantation system or capitalism in Guyana. Those were the times when the planters made it very clear that the time had come to use the rift, or to widen the rift, really, which is an intra-class, intra-working class rift between the African and Indian people. There was a royal commission which visited the Caribbean at the end of the last century, one of the largest of the royal commissions of investigation in the Caribbean. And when they reported, they carried through the evidence of a very important planter, one of the main colonial capitalist firms, joint stock companies operating in Guyana at the time, Sandbach Parker. They had his evidence, and he had a very explicit reference to race. He says, we consider it to be the greatest benefit that we have Africans and Indians working on these plantations. Because whenever there is a problem and the Africans rise up, I have instances of Indian plantation riots and uprisings policed by the black population. It was not until the present century that that manipulative tendency broke down, not because the planters ceased doing it, but because the living experience of struggle within the working class had by then transcended the differences which were partly rooted in economic competition and partly the result of manipulation. So that the living experience of African and Indian workers by the 1920s caused a breakthrough in that process. And in 1924, and again in the 1930s, and again in the early 1950s, African and Indian workers in Guyana made common cause. And it is highly interesting to notice that at the very beginning of this process, indeed, way back in 1905, when there was an uprising of Africans in Guyana, the colonial governor moved against this uprising, and he moved with a tremendous severity and swiftness, because they had intelligence that the Indian indentured workers were about to join the uprising. And they said this would be the most dangerous thing that has happened in the history of this colony, if we had a joint uprising between the Africans and Indians. But of course, in fact, this did occur in the 1930s and in the post-war years. And it seems to me then that we don't just assume that the racial tension, as seems to be present in pluralist analysis, is a consequence of some internal cultural factors, of the fact that Indians are Hindus and Muslims and Africans were mainly connected with the Christian church, or the consequences of the fact that Indians ate and dressed a particular way and Africans might have ate and dressed a different way. Those seem to me to be relatively trivial explanations of why the groups kept apart or occasionally were at each other's throats. Whereas if we take the vision of the colonialists themselves, we see that they recognize the manipulative element in the racial situation. They recognize that for the dynamic of class struggle to be held in check or even to retrogress at particular points, it was necessary to deliberately inculcate racist feelings in specific segments of the population. And so long as they could foster those intra-class conflicts on a racial basis, so long as they could foster that false ideology, then for so long they considered that the system would remain intact. And this is precisely what was to occur in the later years. At the very end of colonialism and at the present time, there are others within the society who are making precisely the same calculation, that the system, the inherited and barely modified system of colonial exploitation, can only be maintained to the extent that intra-class conflicts between Africans and Indians are maintained as a prominent feature in social life. But before we could understand this latter aspect, which is the contemporary reality in Guyana, we need to see how classes emerge in our society other than the peasantry and the working class. We need to trace the rise of intermediary strata who ultimately became the present petty bourgeoisie. Because my contention will be that it is the present petty bourgeoisie as a class who have inherited from the plantation capitalists the tendency to see racism as being in their class interest and to promote racism within the working class and the peasantry to foster their own class interests. Now, who are these individuals? Classes don't drop from the sky. The petty bourgeoisie emerged out of the working class and the peasantry. That is why it is no point anybody from the Caribbean trying to impress you with his or her class origins. Class origins mean nothing in the Caribbean. It's class function. Not where you came from, but where you are going. Because the middle class came out of the working class and the peasantry. There's no doubt about that. Many of the West Indian middle class here can tell you their father was a fisherman or this or that, but it doesn't really cut much ice. The origins of the middle class, in the case of Africans, was slightly different from the case of Indians. Generally speaking, the African middle class tended to be more village-oriented because they lived in the villages. They went to school, had an education, and began to emerge as a middle class by virtue of salaried earnings as teachers and in the junior ranks of the civil service. Later, they moved into professional fields such as law. Law was a very favorite and still remains a favorite form of development for the educated Guyanese and West Indian as a whole. Medicine also. This is the typical development of the African middle class. Village-based, subsequently urban-based, essentially into salaried and professional occupation. The Indian middle class, on the other hand, came primarily out of a landed rural base, because such peasantry as did develop in Guyana in the late 19th century was a rice farming peasantry. I mean a peasantry in the real sense of the word, as being related to the market or being related to capital through the market and through the production of a crop as a commodity. So with the introduction of rice farming, which became important more so in this century than in the last century,
listening to Corey Harris's Walter Rodney. And we've been playing a presentation made by Walter Rodney. Walter Rodney was an incredible African revolutionary out of Guyana, whose influence spread far beyond Guyana. He was assassinated in 1980 by the government of Forbes Burnham. He was a really incredible intellectual who really took on the black middle class that came to power following struggles against direct colonialism. And he was a really, really important force in the African liberation movement. So we're going to continue with the presentation by Walter Rodney on the class analysis in Guyana.
Within the Indian sector of the population, a genuine rice farming peasantry. And it is in the nature of a peasantry in Africa, in Latin America, in Europe before that, and certainly in Guyana, that the peasantry itself differentiates so that you get small peasants and you get people who after a while one must definitely hesitate to call peasants. Even to call them large peasants is a misnomer. They become landlords, they become members of the indigenous petty bourgeoisie. Now this was the route which was taken by a number of Indians. And the collateral activity with rice farming was rice milling or merchandising, so that a large proportion of the retail sector in the community came to be controlled by the Indian petty bourgeoisie. Now there was an overlap. There were a few Africans who had a landed base, but very few. And increasingly in the 1930s, the Indians began to move, Indian professionals and Indian educated sons of millers and farmers and to some extent workers and peasants began to move into the middle class strata. So that from the late 1930s and particularly in the post-war years, there arose a competition, an intra-class competition now within the petty bourgeoisie itself, within the middle class. This emergent middle class had its own competition, a competition in which the African petty bourgeoisie regarded itself as the logical controllers of the bureaucracy, regarded themselves as having primacy in the professions, and regarded themselves as the natural heirs who should inherit colonial power when that state power was passed over. Because as lawyers and as civil servants, they already had a certain degree of integration and constitution within the colonial state. And they felt that ultimately when that state moved off, that they should take power. Meanwhile, the Indian sector of the middle class were recognizing, firstly, that they had to have some room for expansion, that it was not enough to remain on the land or to remain in merchandising, that they too were pushing to have a place in the profession and in the civil service sectors, and they too recognize that ultimately state power would be a decisive factor in whether or not they could continue to accumulate on the land or to accumulate as private merchant capitalists. As is true of any capitalist class, it will realize its interest and will realize that it must in some way be associated with the state if surplus realization is to be real. And so the Indian middle class was not prepared to allow the African middle class to assume that it would have taken control of the state in Guyana. Consequently, an examination of the 20s and the 30s and subsequently seems to suggest that at a particular juncture, the consciousness of race was not a consciousness arising out of the contradictions within the working class, but rather a consciousness arising out of contradictions within this emergent petty bourgeoisie. And that as they articulated their own, they very deliberately utilized the same strategy and tactics that had been used by the colonial masters, by the actual controllers of the state, and by the plantation capitalists of an earlier era. That the Indian capitalists, for instance, one must infer this, as they did not necessarily say this, but there is a sense in which to speak about race was a defense of their own exploitative activity within the Indian community, because the Indian middle class could only have arisen within the interstices of the plantation system. The plantation system didn't give you much room for accumulating. So if you're going to accumulate, you can't do so at the expense of capital per se. You can only do so at the expense of labor, which means at the expense of your fellow laborers, at the expense of your fellow peasants. So Indian accumulation came not out of capital, as it existed in the 19th century or in the present century, nor did it come out of Africans, which is interestingly enough. Primarily, Indian capital was accumulated on the basis of exploiting other Indians. That if an Indian were appointed as the driver in the estate, which is a term reminiscent again of slavery, the foreman in the slave context was a driver, he was a slave driver, and after slavery he remained a driver. When an Indian was appointed as a driver, he regarded that as an appointment that offered the possibilities of accumulation and used it as such, partially, if he could, to defraud the plantation. But since that was extremely difficult with the overseer looking over his shoulder, it was easier to make a deal with the overseer to defraud the workers, because that was going on anyhow. He just needed to take his share. And therefore, that was one of the areas of accumulation, in alliance with things like petty shopkeeping and the control over the distribution of goods to the same indentured population. On the land, landlordship became the key feature in the late 19th century and in the present century. Most of the land which passed into Indian hands, which was owned on a large scale by a few Indians, was not worked by them. They set up certain tenancy relations, which were extremely onerous and exploitative of their fellow Indian population. And it seems to me that in order to accumulate within the community, this sector of the Indian petty bourgeoisie needed to have certain mechanisms that reinforced the solidarity of the community, as it were. It was essential that they should not have been perceived in their class guise, but rather that they should have been perceived as Indians, as brothers, because then that would lessen the potential and the real contradiction between themselves and fellow Indian workers or fellow Indian peasants. It doesn't seem to me surprising that most of the Indian accumulators were also prominent in the religious field. There were leading Hindus or leading Muslims, and that they carried out the necessary rites of charity, of giving food and so on at particular times of the year, and that they were the ones always in the forefront of defending the Indians. Now then, that when that concept came into being of the Indians, when that was being reiterated, it was being done at a time when the Indians were already differentiated, when there was already the barefoot indentured worker on the one hand and the landowner with 600 acres who had himself moved into a new class. And it seems to me that one always, a generalization I would be prepared to extend to most third world countries, certainly to the African examples which I know, that in the process of accumulation, in the process of differentiation of a subordinated class, those who are emergent are usually the most strident in maintaining the concept of identity of the subordinated group, because that identity is itself a cover for their accumulation. No one shouted, "African, African, I am an African," more than the people like Kenyatta and so on, who were at the same time ruthlessly exploiting the African people. It was an ideological reflex that countered the possibility that amongst their own people, they would begin to be identified as outsiders, not as insiders, not as Kikuyu or African, but as exploiter, in order to avoid that idea from developing, or to slow down the rate of its development. It was important to pursue the notion that the community is an integral community and has interests as a community that are fundamentally opposed to the other community. Similarly, the African lawyers in the Afro-Guyanese sector continue to behave as though All Afro-Guyanese existed to serve the interests of Afro-Guyanese lawyers and Afro-Guyanese petty bourgeois. And they still think in that way. It is an automatic identification of their personal interests with the group interests, occasionally with the national interest, but in this instance with the racial group interest, and a conscious attempt to mobilize support amongst the Afro-Guyanese population in order to capture state power. But the capture of state power was not going to be shared by the masses of the Afro-Guyanese, quite obviously not. It was the capture of state power by a segment of the petty bourgeoisie, namely the Afro-Guyanese petty bourgeoisie. And they found it most convenient to manipulate racist symbols and racial... in the pursuit of that class objective. It is true that if there is an intra-class conflict, it doesn't mean that the class disintegrates. It doesn't mean that the notion of class has to be discarded. What we're in effect saying is that the working class exists firstly as a concept. The relationships are established between labor and capital. The conceptualization of that is that those who are the laborers, who provide the labor, respond in a particular way and can only respond in that way, this is important, it's not choice, can only respond in that way to their relationship with capital. And that provides a link which, irrespective of whether it is operative at the level of consciousness, is a real link in the society. That's a point we can generally make. But we need to go further and recognize that classes do actualize themselves historically in different ways. The rates at which they cohere, the times at which they come together, the possibilities of their united action, the possibilities of their joint organization are all things that have to be considered on their own merit. And it is true that in the Guyanese situation, for the longest while, and still today, it remains true that the working classes have not actualized a unity at the level of organization. They have had sporadic instances of common activity, but have not yet forged a link at the level of organization, which is an irreversible link. There was a very tenuous and temporary arrangement in the 1950s, and that collapsed. And at the moment, there is still the process of trying to rebuild that link. Meanwhile, the petty bourgeoisie itself, although divided on racial grounds, does in fact continue to operate as a class with its own set of interests. And this can easily be discerned by looking at the way in which there is a selective integration of the African and Indian petty bourgeoisie in the Guyanese context. They have a hostility to each other, there is a rivalry, but there is at the same time a working relationship. Because to the extent that there is national capital in Guyana, that national capital is Indian. It exploits both African labor and Indian labor. It exploits a market which has consumers who are both African and Indian. And that Indian capital has its relationship with the state, which is presently staffed by and manned and commanded by the African petty bourgeoisie. So that when the state continues to guarantee the conditions for the realization of profit by private capital, and that private capital is Indian, that is the most important link within the class. Whether they like each other, whether they go to the same parties, whether they sleep with each other, it's really, these are very secondary, although they sometimes do these things. But what is important is that together they have a working relationship, so that the African petty bourgeoisie is at the moment, or sectors of it, because there's some other complications, sectors of it are accumulating by virtue of extending statist control over aspects of the economy, whereas other sectors of the economy remain in private, essentially in Indian private hands, and there is that alliance between the two. Sometimes the alliance is overt and open and legal. Sometimes it is illegal because a great deal of the corruption that develops in these so-called socialist states, the ones that practice some economic nationalism and nationalized sectors of production, a lot of the corruption which goes on has to do with the fact that the existence of a private capital capitalist sector is recognized by those who hold state power, and they make deals over and above the formal relations that guide the state in its relations with capital. So they make private deals with capital. In our instance, recently there have been a number of scandals, for instance, in relationship to foreign exchange. And it's not surprising that who are the parties involved? On the one hand, top bureaucrats, invariably Afro-Guyanese bureaucrats, and on the other hand, private businessmen, invariably Indian businessmen. Now that is the type of link that constitutes the real nexus of that class, and means that both segments of that class are engaged in an exploitative operation vis-a-vis African and Indian working people. What is true is that there is a continued contradiction between the Indian and African petty bourgeoisie for hegemony over the class and over the state. They do compete for that. The Afro-Guyanese petty bourgeoisie has hegemony over the state, and to that extent they do subordinate the Indian petty bourgeoisie. They determine the rate of exactions which they take from Indian private capital, and Indian private capital would resent this. They determine which Indians are taken in to the collaborative apparatus. Sometimes they go and they take Indian reactionaries from the early period who were anti-colonialists, and they bring them into the apparatus. Sometimes they try to get Indians from the opposition party, people who might even have called themselves Marxists at one stage, and they bring them in also. But essentially the determination of who should come in is made by the Afro-Guyanese sector. And they usually carry out the policy which is well known over here of, you know, appointing a spook to sit by the door, so that a certain number of Indians are appointed to sit by the door. And this is done by the essentially Afro-Guyanese state. Meanwhile, of course, they control the military apparatus so that there should be no doubt as to who has the real coercive power. But it seems to me that that does not remove the fundamentals of the situation. Because here now we move into the stage of remedies, the stage of how one transforms that given situation. And in our present position, there are a number of people who have felt, or who do feel, that if they're Indians, that is to say, whether they come from the middle class or whether they come from the working class or the peasantry, it could be that they succumb to a vision of the society as being racial. It could be that they interpret the present reality of exploitation and oppression as being essentially an African reality of exploitation and oppression. Just as, what, 12, 14 years ago, Africans came to realization, an erroneous conclusion, that the exploitation which they suffered at that time was the responsibility of, quote-unquote, the Indians, or an Indian government. It is only in the interest of the two sectors of the petty bourgeoisie, as it used to be in the interest of plantation capital, to promote this view. And it is a view that can be shown to be erroneous, both in a sort of detached historical context for the 19th century and for the early 20th century, and that can be shown to be erroneous from the viewpoint of political action. Because the options which are available, if one takes the pluralist, if one takes the racist analysis, the options are, as presently propounded in Guyana, you have a right-wing Indian party, for example, which will be perfectly prepared to take over from what is a de facto right-wing African administration. They would argue in racial terms, but in effect, the kind of society which they wish to reimpose is no different from the kind of society which the IMF conceptualizes. And the present regime is carrying out the dictates of the IMF, so that it remains merely a change, a shift from one sector of the petty bourgeoisie to another. the interpretation of the reality in Guyana as propounded by the Indian right wing, even if it does, as it must, gain some credibility from social distress amongst all sectors of the population, is intended only to reinforce the same reality. They cannot offer any other alternatives. And therefore, in Guyana as elsewhere, one turns to the producer classes themselves to see where the dynamic for change resides. In a certain sense, it's a very obvious argument. It is just that whereas in Jamaica, to make that argument, one simply has to overcome the distinctions between two traditional political parties with no outward racial differences, in our context, it seems to be complicated by the racial factor. And it is no point simply, as some Marxists would do, as some progressives would do, it would be no point simply dismissing the racial factor as an aberration. It has historical roots. It has to be analyzed and discerned in a particular way so that the remedies can also be propounded in a very practical way. And the two dimensions of the problem which remain to be resolved, one is resolved at the level of ideology and the other is resolved by social transformation. The one is that in our society, the racial segmentation arose historically and was maintained as a deliberate way of holding down the level of wages and of increasing the control of capital over labor. That was the function of racial segmentation. It was precisely that that also conditioned the monopoly of land by private capital and subsequently by the state, all in the interest of ensuring that the working class as a whole would not increase the level of its returns of the social surplus. And all a way of ensuring that the control, which was a very weak control by economic means, should in fact be reinforced by non-economic means. Now that being so, it follows that the resolution of the so-called racial differences is not merely ideational. We can't just persuade an African to like an Indian or vice versa. One has to create a situation in which the rivalry and insecurity based on economic grounds have to be eliminated. So long as that colonial economy, that lopsided colonial economy remains, for so long there is an actual base for racist experiments to be carried out, as it were. This has proved very dramatically in recent times when the government introduced a large number of African workers deliberately as scab labor to undermine the strike of the essentially Indian, present-day Indian working class on the sugar estates. And they could do that because of the conditions of competition, the conditions of fantastic unemployment, which makes it possible to mobilize scab labor in the thousands and to give it that racial twist. But the issue which we can deal immediately is of the issue of racist ideology, to pinpoint its social origin, to recognize as having come at all stages out of the exploitative classes. This is not to present some naive view which suggests that workers are not racist and peasants are not racist. This is not what I'm saying at all. But to the extent that racism is an ideology, we must seek not merely its social and cultural roots, but its class roots as well. And I'm suggesting that its class roots lie outside of the working class. And therefore, from a working class perspective, while workers can be racist, within the working class it can be described as false consciousness, as false ideology, because it can be shown as not advancing the interests of that particular class, the working class. I can't go to persuade a petty bourgeois who happens to be racist not to be racist in his own class interest. If he or she feels that racism advances their class, well, that is how it is. But it seems to me that we are in a position to illustrate, and to illustrate from not just the distant past, but the recent history of Guyana, that race is an aberration viewed from a working class point of view, that it is maintained deliberately by classes whose interests contradict with the classes, with the interests of the working class. Now that formulation, I believe, is already gaining ground in our own society, not just because people get up and say it in an academic way, but because there has been the concrete experience of African workers having to deal with a so-called African government headed by Prime Minister Forbes Burnham, and that has been an enlightening experience in their understanding what African, quote-unquote, means in terms of exploitation and oppression in class terms. So there is a basis in experience through which the working class is moving to this consideration. I will conclude then, in a way, as I began at the outset, by emphasizing that issues such as these aren't really to be resolved by endless debates where people put forward their own ideological postulate and imagine that it is true because they feel it to be consistent with a particular ideology which they hold. There is a circularity about that debate. In fact, after a while, it even ceases to be circular and it becomes totally divergent because people don't even listen to each other. They just repeat ad nauseum, I think that race is more important, or I think that class is more important. Or even if they say that there is a mix, it isn't just that there is a mix in an abstract sense, but in every concrete historical situation, it manifests itself in different ways, depending not merely on the principal class contradiction, but depending on other more subtle variations of intra-class relations that might be developing. So that if one were to try to conduct this analysis for, let us say, Zimbabwe or some other place, the formulation might well be different because the specific historical conditions that govern the so-called ethnic or tribal, so-called tribal differences in that situation might present themselves differently. But ultimately, what cannot seem to be, you can eliminate that dimension. You may keep a proletariat backward or divide. The relationship between capital and labor is bound to assert itself. In our context, it took maybe 70 odd dimensions. You may keep a proletariat backward or divided, but provided capital as a self-expanding value is operating in that society, either directly through wage labor or indirectly through the market, then it follows that, irrespective of all internal contradictions, intra-class contradictions in the working class, the presence of that fundamental contradictory relationship between capital and labor is bound to assert itself. In our context, it took maybe 70-odd years before it could be said that the racial cohesion of the working class had overcome the introduction of indentured labor as a divisive force in the working class. And even after that date, we have had epochs of retrogression. So it's not an easy matter. But it does seem to me that over the historical run, there can be no doubt about the primacy in a class society of the class factor. I think I will stop at that point.
You're listening to WhoRadio.com, voice of the International African Revolution.
Africa Live here on WhoRadio.com. I'm your host, Nyabinga Zimbabwe. You were just listening to Walter Rodney, great African leader from Guyana, who was an African martyr. He's a martyr in the African liberation struggle. was assassinated on June 13th, 1980 by the neo-colonial government of Forbes Burnham. We're going to get ready to close the program out. I want to thank the brothers who were on with me earlier today, cast members of the play Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, which is in a run right now at the American Stage Theater Company at Raymond James Theater in St. Petersburg, Florida. If you're in this area, you should check that out. It's the play has extended its run to February 20th, this coming weekend. I also want to note that this coming weekend, the convention, the 20th anniversary convention of the International People's Democratic Uhuru Movement, will be held in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania on February 19th through 21st. If you're not there, you're missing out. You should be there at the convention. It's being held under the slogan, "Africans have a right to resist freedom and reparations now." Come to this historic convention. It's going to be really, really important convention, and we're going to be broadcasting it live for those of you who are not able to make it to the convention. You'll be able to participate here on the Uhuru News and UhuruRadio.com. So stick with us for that, for this coming weekend for the MPDM convention. That's it here on Africa Live on the UhuruRadio.com.
The popular rebellion in Egypt has already taken years off the life of U.S. imperial power. Even if the rebellion somehow fizzled overnight, which cannot and will not happen, it has already engaged and enraged millions across the Arab world. A sea change is taking place in the region, the likes of which has not been experienced in at least two generations, and maybe not since the so-called Arab Awakening following World War I. The Americans are in panic because, even with a military machine that is more expensive than the armed forces of the rest of the world combined, the United States does not possess the tools to control a whole people that are bent on achieving self-determination. And when it comes to the Arab world, we're talking about peoples with ties that bind across national borders, from the Atlantic to the Indian Ocean. With the exception of the 2003 Iraq invasion, the United States has dominated the region mainly by co-opting or outright creating corrupt ruling classes in the various Arab countries. While the process may begin with cultivation of a strongman or a king, the subordination of a whole country to Washington's will, especially a huge one like Egypt, requires that American corporations and global institutions of capital gain a stranglehold on the local political economy. A whole class of businessmen is created who are allied with foreign corporate powers, not with their own countrymen. Their job is to make their countries safe for foreign capital and willing tools of American policy, and in the case of Egypt and Jordan, even partners with Israel. In order to fulfill their deal with U.S. imperialism, the local rulers have no choice but to wage constant war against their own people. These corrupt politicians and businessmen's arrangement with Washington requires that they crush the national aspirations of their fellow citizens. There is no escaping the logic of the police state unless the country is freed from the grip of imperialism, which is a form of foreign rule. That's why it's a sure sign that the U.S. is panicking when President Obama flails about, pretending to be on the side of Egypt's popular rebellion while desperately maneuvering to keep men loyal to Washington in control. Men like former Chief of Intelligence Omar Suleiman, Hosni Mubarak's hand-picked vice president, who was also America's go-to guy for extraordinary rendition in the so-called War on Terror. But the Egyptian people know him better as the man who has waged a war of terror on them. And there are plenty of Egyptian Suleimans in Washington service, in government, in the military, and in business. Actually, they're all in the business of profiting from imperialism. That's why the protesters in Tahrir Square keep expanding the list of the men that are unacceptable to Egypt's future. It started off with one person, Mubarak. Now, as the revolution progresses, the list of enemies becomes larger as the people realize that a whole class of traitors to the nation must be disempowered. The realization grows that if Egypt is to be free,